Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome again to Symmetry of Soul, a virtual study group for students of the Urantia book and all who are interested in the teachings of the Fifth Epochal Revelation. I'm Ann Garner, and I'm here once again with my three co-hosts, Dr. Chris Halverson, James Woodward, and Kermit Anderson. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Ann. Welcome, everyone. Hi, James. Hi, Kermit. Glad you all could join us.
Hey, James.
Hey, guys. I am thrilled to be here tonight with three of my all-time favorite people and everybody else who's listening in. Glad you could come along.
For sure. Welcome, everybody. Hey, Kermit.
Hey, Ann, and all of our great co-hosts and loyal listeners. Glad to be here tonight. Last week we did part four of our ongoing series, Jesus, Teacher of Living Truth. We're in paper 140, The Ordination of the Twelve. And we started with section 8, Thursday afternoon on the lake. The apostles persisted in attempting to put Jesus' new wine into the old wineskins of their traditional beliefs and entrenched literal concepts of the kingdom, representing the restoration of David's throne and the establishment of Israel as a temporal power. Accordingly, Jesus decided to provide further intensive instruction to Peter, James, and John, that they might provide clarification of these things to their associates. The authors state that the narrative for this instruction, as presented in the Fifth Epochal Revelation, was a reorganized summary of Peter's account of the four-hour teaching conference as given to Andrew. This teaching event encompassed Jesus' attitudes concerning doing the Father's will and the realms of politics, the social conduct, economics, and personal religion. It was pointed out that while we are presented here with Jesus' teachings, the actual record was taken from Peter's account as given to Andrew. And we all confessed to having a vague sense of deprivation, wishing the authors had paraphrased Jesus' own words. In this broadcast, we covered doing the Father's will, political attitude, and social attitude. As has been mentioned, Jesus' mission was to live his life in accordance with the Father's will. That the preeminence of the individual is central to his message is perfectly aligned with the fact that the Father only relates to the individual. That Jesus' mission was exclusively a spiritual one likewise accounts for the absence of prescriptive pronouncements of a political, social, or economic nature in his public ministry. So we need to be clear on the nature of these teachings appearing in the Fifth Epochal Revelation from Jesus. They go beyond the Fourth Epochal Revelation limitations, but are completely in line with the Fifth Revelation mandate. So the misapplication of Jesus' Fourth Epochal Revelation teachings to the extra-personal and other non-spiritual domains, other than spiritual domains of human activity, must be sorted through and reflected on by the serious follower of Jesus, as to avoid a complete distortion of the Fifth Epochal Revelation's purpose. Now let us look at the three topics we covered last week. One, doing the Father's will. Jesus' approval of the old Hebrew saying, "He who will not work shall not eat," was put into perspective by a passage in paper 69, which points out that the Hebrews were the first tribe to put a supreme premium on industry. Jesus distinguished between the requirements of discipleship and apostleship, affirming the exercise of prudence and foresight. He countenanced forethought, not anxiety or worry. He pointed to his life experiences as a carpenter, boatmaker, and fisherman to illustrate the benefits of frugality and thriftiness. His personal practice of non-resistance was difficult for the apostles to understand. And for 2,000 years, his followers have stumbled over this practice when evaluating not only the social or group response to violence, but an individual response to violence. For elsewhere in the Revelation, Jesus clarifies the distinction between mercy, personal, and justice, group responses to wrongdoing, and further explains that should he come under attack by one whom he discerns to be lacking in moral judgment and spiritual reason, he would defend himself to the utmost. His instructions are aimed at the individual, not the state. Summarized, the Master's instructions are to love your enemies, that fighting evil with its own weapons is a futile practice, and to have faith in the eventual triumph of divine justice and eternal goodness. Under political attitude, Jesus counseled against becoming embroiled in the political affairs of the Jews and the Romans. Render to Caesar the things which are Caesar's and to God the things which are God's was Jesus' common response to his enemies' attempts to ensnare him in political controversy. His mission was to establish a new way of salvation. In his personal life, he was duly observant of all civil laws, but in his public teachings, he ignored the civic, social, and economic realms. Yet here in the fifth epical revelation, we are given numerous suggestions and direction for reforming all of these realms, inasmuch as the new way of salvation has been established for 2,000 years. Number three, the social attitude. Jesus expanded the neighborhood to include the whole world. However, his interest was in the individual, not the mass. He also warned against indiscriminate kindness as a cause of many social evils. His purpose in all social situations was to teach patience, tolerance, and forgiveness. In exalting family life as the highest human duty, he made it plain that family obligations were not to interfere with religious obligations. He demonstrated this in giving up his own family when the family ran counter to the Father's will. Now we prepare to continue with the restatement of the remainder of Jesus' four-hour teaching conference with Peter, James, and John. Any additions or subtractions?
No, just a big wow. you nailed it. You nailed it, Kermit, especially thank you for that little clarification about the different epical revelations. Boy, that is just, it's really important. And it's not an easy one to sift through. And you nailed it really nicely how we are called to sort through that little bugger.
Yep. Thank you.
Any other comments? Anybody before we move on here and step into the study group?
I'm ready to go.
Well, then let's take off here. As usual, I'll set the stage for us here. Once again, we are in paper 140, Ordination of the 12. And our reading will begin on page 1581 of the single column version. This is section 8, entitled Thursday Afternoon by the Lake. And we are on section 4, Economic Attitude.
Or subsection 4.
Thank you. That precise thing.
And so, you probably don't have it in front of you, James. For those who need a paragraph number, that's paragraph 15 in section 8.
Yes. I do have that. I'm double barreled here, Chris. I got the book sitting here in front of me, and I have the Urantia book in ebook form sitting here on the monitor in front of me. So double barreled. I'm kind of old school. I like the book, but it's actually kind of nice to read it off the screen. It's nice and bright. Subsection 4, paragraph 15. Economic attitude. Jesus worked, lived, and traded in the world as he found it. He was not an economic reformer, although he did frequently call attention to the injustice of the unequal distribution of wealth, but he did not offer any suggestions by way of remedy. He made it plain to the three that while his apostles were not to hold property, he was not preaching against wealth and property, merely its unequal and unfair distribution. He recognized the need for social justice and industrial fairness, but he offered no rules for their attainment.
So as we were saying at the end of the broadcast last time, there's a lot of things that we can touch upon in this little set of paragraphs about economic attitude. So we're gonna launch in and sort of see where the Spirit moves us in talking about some of the issues that followers of Jesus for 2,000 years have struggled mightily with, and even all those who have engaged now the fully revealed teachings through the fifth epical revelation are still struggling with. There's a lot of very precise and subtle and tricky issues even that you have to carefully reflect on and think about. Just take, for instance, just simply noticing how carefully they worded it two times in a row there, the unequal distribution of wealth, not the unequal possession of wealth, but the distribution. And, that's a quick one to get confused. It's like, well, I see it unequally distributed out there. No, did you watch it being distributed, or are you looking at it in possession? How do you know it was unequally distributed just because it's unequally possessed? So they're very careful about that, kind of that point of it's not preaching against wealth and property. They're very careful to say injustice. The word just has to do with law abiding and honest. And so when they say unequal, they mean two individuals, have worked the same number of hours in the field with the same commitment to their labors, and the boss, is good friends with one of them, so he pays him twice as much as the other one. That's unjust. That's an unequal distribution of wealth. So it's that specific issue. You notice that they also bring in an issue that maybe is not quite as commonly struggled with these days as it was a few decades back, but that whole issue of private property, and they're going to pick up on it a little bit more as we go forward. I thought maybe we could just look at it right up front here. It's a great example of, decades ago when students of the Revelation were reading some of these passages, it was not uncommon for someone to point out, well, wait a minute, it looks like the Revelation is speaking against communism.
Yeah.
And many would say, well, no, I mean, it's very clear that we're not supposed to be engaging political, social, or economic attitudes as followers of Jesus. And to bring up the idea that somehow the fifth epical revelation is addressing something like communism is a distortion of what it says. And that's just like what Kermit was trying to point out. It's not something that you should do if you're trying to just forward the fourth epical revelation to sort of pick up the ball that in many ways the apostles dropped 2,000 years ago. But the fifth epical revelation takes on, for instance, the issue of communism very straight on, and has a lot of very specific things to say about it. If we want to take a little peek at that, there's a whole section on private property in paper 69. I'm not going to read that whole section, but just pointing out, you literally have a section in the Revelation entitled private property. So that's I wanted to just point out a couple paragraphs that are at the end of that section, very long section, on page 782 in the single column. So just looking at those last couple paragraphs, which I guess, let's see, those would be paragraphs 17 and 18. The last two there, right before the byline. And just give people who are not familiar with some of these papers outside of the Jesus papers how the revelators approach these subjects. So let me just read those last two. The right to property is not absolute. It is purely social. But all government, law, order, civil rights, social liberties, conventions, peace, and happiness, as they are enjoyed by modern peoples, have grown up around the private ownership of property. And that, stressing the importance of that, there's several places in paper 71, paper 81, for instance, where they really try to point out how indispensable private property is to getting civilization going. This particular section is, you go back in the earlier parts of this section, they're talking extensively about how communism is sort of the most primitive of ideas that humans began to order themselves with, and it was quickly outgrown. And so that's the spirit of then this next paragraph, where it says the present social order is not necessarily right, not divine or sacred, but mankind will do well to move slowly in making changes. That which you have is vastly better than any system known to your ancestors. Make certain that when you change the social order, you change for the better. Do not be persuaded to experiment with the discarded formulas of your forefathers. Go forward, not backward. Let evolution proceed. Do not take a backward step. And that points out one of the really helpful things about the Fifth Epical Revelation is they give you the whole history, all the important elements in our history, that you know where we've been, you know what we've tried, you know why we outgrew them or why they failed. Like just in that third of the last paragraph, they mentioned that the private ownership of land was given social sanction only after communal control and direction had failed.
Yes. I'm glad you stepped back to that, Chris. Yeah.
You know, there's a number of people who are rediscovering that. Like maybe there's a park in their town, and they decided, we really need to, this shouldn't be under private ownership. This should be public property. So they put it in the hands of the public property, and the park just went right down the toilet. And so they, after much consternation, they finally decided, okay, well, let's put it back in private hands. And immediately the park was beautiful and clean and functioning again, and you could actually dare to use the restrooms. that's what the revelators are pointing out, that humans actually tried that and discovered that very thing long, long, millennia ago. and we've forgotten it. So this fact that we've forgotten a lot of very important lessons, it's really helpful to have the revelators restore those lessons learned for us. So we don't have to keep making the same mistakes over and over again every generation when we forget.
Oh, but why do we? Yeah, that's right, because we continue to do that. I was going to say, why, oh, why?
Well, you remarked last week, I believe, that, you know, someone asked in the chat room last week for prescriptions that the fifth epical revelators were giving us regarding these things. And here we are in a section of the book that I think you alluded to the fact that maybe a lot of people, not having a lot of spiritual content, these civilization papers, are not as well read and not as popular, so-called popular, among devotees of the book because of that. And those lessons are embedted in there, and that those teachings are to be found in there. So
yeah, it's very important to understand. It doesn't matter what kind of facts they're dealing with. If they're dealing about the facts of cephalopods, or if they're dealing about the facts of taxation, or whatever the heck they're talking about, there's truth flowing through every one of those paragraphs. Truth that's extremely important to recognize and to strike step with today, with today's facts. There isn't any part of the book that doesn't have truth flowing through it. That can be not immediately appreciated if all you have is the initial jump start, kind of kick start that God gives us in relationship to truth, where we have an initial faint flicker of recognition of spiritual truth, but not the full spectrum of truth, not scientific truth, you know, governmental truth, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so to begin to expand your horizons of truth, you know, and see how there's very, very helpful, relevant truth that can be obeyed to the betterment of yourself and to all of mankind every place in the book.
Yeah, that's good stuff to point out, Chris. Thank you for that. And I would also I would point out the following paper, you know, in that same what some people, you know, consider the dry sands, paper 71, the development of the state, has some really good stuff in there, particularly on page 804 and 805, the section 4, 5. And six, section four is titled Progressive Civilization, and it starts out saying economics, society, and government must evolve if they are to remain. And then it gives a list, number three, of important things being promotion of economic security. On the facing page there, section five is recommended reading here, I would say, The Evolution of Competition, which goes into this even more. And number six, the profit motive, and the first paragraph there ties in with exactly what we're talking about here, with the teachings of Jesus. And I would read that on page 805. Present day profit motive economics is doomed unless profit motives can be augmented by service motives. Ruthless competition based on narrow-minded self-interest is ultimately destructive of even those things which it seeks to maintain. Exclusive and self-serving profit motivation is incompatible with Christian ideals, much more incompatible with the teachings of Jesus. So that one, you know, just here we are, development of the state, and talking about all this stuff about statehood, and all of a sudden the teachings of Jesus pops in there when they're discussing the prophet. Those are little gems that we love.
Yeah, I mean, and that section is a great one. How, you know, they put that forward, and then they remind you of, just like they did with communism. You know that, but whatever you do, don't make the mistake of trying to eliminate profit motive by fiat. You've got to let it evolve to service motive.
Right.
You know, that it'll be cataclysmic if you try. Matter of fact, you know, profit motive is one of the four indispensables to the progress of early civilization.
Ah, that's right. Those indispensables. There it is in the third paragraph.
Yeah.
Along with slavery and war. Yeah.
Slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Those four indispensables to early progressing civilization. And profit motive must not be taken away from men until they have firmly possessed themselves of superior types of nonprofit motives for economic striving and social serving, etc. And that's what we bring up so often with the fifth epic of Revelation. It's trying to get us to reconsecrate ourselves to that progress toward a people who have the internal integrity that doesn't make those four harsh indispensables indispensable. They tell you, you got a lot of work to do because it's sad to record that so few persons don't need a cattle prod. The law is not written in their hearts. They don't self-motivate progress.
You keep one of those in the Friday night study group, Chris?
We have to try to somehow deal with our burning idealism that so yearns for the age of light and life, and being able to let go of these harsh indispensables of the early ages. But they know that, and that's why they constantly will use the word must. It's like, I know the tension you're feeling, they're saying, but you must not, have change without growth, because change without growth is potential evil. You'll get the exact opposite of what you're hoping for if you try to change it by fiat rather than letting God the Supreme grow you there. Trust God the Supreme.
He's with us out here in time and space.
Yeah, and, like I said, 71 in the early part, there's just all kinds of fascinating little tidbits, like they explain to you why it was fundamentally that the more advanced Amerinds, red man in North America, failed to really reach the nation level. Go from clan to tribe, getting up to nation, and they just couldn't make it to nation and hold it. And one of the reasons is because they didn't have the acquirement and inheritance of private property.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of idealistic people point to that as one of the greatest things that red man has to offer man is the rejection of private property. And what do the revelators say? No, that is one of the worst things that led to their downfall.
Oh, no, Chris. We're going to get the cards and letters now.
I know. There it is. Number one, black and white.
You've referred before to this problem of the Urantia book reading community really failing to recognize this, and at our own peril. I mean, it's right here in black and white, but to engage it and allow your own preconceived notions, settled ideas, etc., to be reformed. The more favored response is generally, let's skip over that. Let's go to the next one. Let's wait for something titillating. Spiritually titillating.
Oh, man.
You mean my spiritual candy that I'm always offering?
There you go.
Look out.
It's sweet. Take a bite. It won't hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah, and what do you get? Truth decay.
Very good.
Yeah.
That That was great.
Well, I borrowed it.
We do have a question.
Musician friend.
We do have a question in the chat room. Don't we see a lot of service motivation in capitalism of today, profit motive? I think, that there is a combining of the two, a step forward, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to recognize. They evolve, in reciprocal fashion. As one finds natural place, the other naturally fades. You know, there's no artificial imposition of that evolution. And so for those who are interested in that that area of human civilization, you know, they can try to find the wisdom to figure out how to take certain sectors of our economy and evolve them into more of a service motive driven sector, but yet still have it be able to fit into a system with the profit motive sectors. It's going to take some very wise people to construct that system. You know, how do you make that all work so that you can have that evolutionary transition over the centuries?
Right. Well, you know, the first the knee-jerk reaction is to reject the profit motive. I mean, that's of course what the Bolsheviks did and others along the lines, is just to reject it, just to kick it out, gone, and you know, try to supplement with something else. And of course, we know that's a backwards direction.
No.
But interesting what you say there about reciprocity having to evolve, that it cannot be forced.
Yeah, you're just slowly tipping a teeter-totter from one side to the other, you know. And it takes no wisdom at all to just outlaw profit, you know. Now, try to outlaw profit motive. That's a little trickier. and of course that's what humans, you know, discovered a long time ago. You can't outlaw profit motive. Doesn't matter how many laws you pass, doesn't matter how totalitarian the state, it doesn't change biology one iota.
It's going to bubble up, and usually in some rather interesting ways.
you will. It'll eventually all fall apart, and you'll be back in worse shape than when your attempted enlightenment began.
And by the same token...
And by the same token, the revelation is very, very nuanced in allowing, I mean, in recognizing and publishing some of the ills or some of the consequences, the bad consequences of say, profit motive or capitalism or whatever, and they're very careful to condemn those practices without countenancing just throwing everything overboard. So that has to be read very carefully in those regards.
Yeah, I mean, can you distinguish between capital and capitalism?
Mm-hmm.
It's the ism on any word that's the issue, not the root.
All right.
Capital is an indispensable part of the evolutionary process. No planet can get to light and life without capital. But to try to turn every noun that you can think of into a complete lifestyle solution by sticking ism on the end, that's a problem. And it's becoming more and more of a problem because literally we're just about out of nouns in the dictionary now in the modern age.
Sorry, isms. Good
point. Are we out of isms?
No, the capacity for human innovation, I think will keep us going with those for some time now. My goodness. Well, look at that. We've read one paragraph.
There's a lot of really, enjoyable, illuminating stuff to really kind of get your gears turning in a new way. It's like, wow, I never thought thinking about it like that. And so I hope our listeners appreciate, us spending a little time talking about some of these issues.
Yeah, and hopefully, I think they do.
Yeah, hopefully it'll inspire a greater scrutiny of some of these less well-traveled parts of the book.
He never taught his followers to avoid earthly possessions, only his 12 apostles. Luke, the physician, was a strong believer in social equality, and he did much to interpret Jesus' sayings in harmony with his personal beliefs. Jesus never personally directed his followers to adopt a communal mode of life. He made no pronouncement of any sort regarding such matters. We see that word communal there again. But of course,
like I said, they're reminding of it there. And, it occurred to me, maybe we ought to just point out to people, since why are they specifically bringing up Luke? If for no other reason, it's because we studied the Beatitudes here just a few sections back in this paper, and that's a great example of what they're talking about. What Luke did with the Beatitudes, we mentioned that in passing at the time, that he had, he had a few of the blessed are, or the happy are lines, but he creates a parallel set after that of woes.
Yes, he did.
And this is where you can really see this bias that they're talking about. I suppose I could just read that.
Yeah, I'm there if you'd like me. Are you?
Or go ahead. You read it. Yeah, go ahead.
The whole thing or just the woes?
We just read those woes. Yeah.
Just
so people can see the how he's playing it.
Yeah, but woe to you that are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you that are full now, for you shall hunger. Woe to you that laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so did their fathers did to the false prophets. But he started out with, woe to you that are rich.
Right. And every one of them is, he's in a full, just materialistic mode of, yeah, interpreting the Beatitudes, and then flipping them around, as this just full-on attack, that if you've managed to get any foothold out of the nutrition epoch and the security age into the material comfort era, you be damned. This has been plaguing Christianity for 2,000 years, like they're pointing out, because of, Luke putting his ism into Jesus' mouth. And it all begins with a subtlety that you don't have to be a Christian for the last 2,000 years to have gotten tripped up in this. It is one of the most significant little false beginnings that leads to catastrophic results that there is. It is one of the primary reasons why we're reading the fifth epical revelation right now. The fact that instead of precisely social justice, Luke heard social equality.
Yeah.
One is true and the other is very problematically false. Very false. that idea to think that that what should be made manifest is social equality. It's rooted in a fundamental lack of recognition that comes from your initial recognition that you're a child of God. And you know, you feel that kindred spirit fact when you begin to recognize there's a God and you're the child of that God. And you don't precisely interpret that experience. You come to the false conclusion that all men are born equal. But they're not. All men are created equal. Because the equality is spiritual, not material or mental. It's just spiritual. And to make that mistake, to not distinguish between being created equal as kindred spirits and being born equal, is the beginning, you know, of, like I said, you know, a solid one-fourth, if not more, of the reason that there's a fifth epical revelation. You know, it's very, very problematic. Just a simple example of how truth begins to slip through man's fingers when he takes that step. Think about Paper 3, Section 5, with the inevitabilities, which is on page 51. The second inevitability, which I guess would be paragraph 7 there in paper 3, section 5. Now just notice what they say here. Is altruism, service to one's fellows, desirable? Then must life experience provide for encountering situations of social inequality? There must be social inequality. If you try to short-circuit that by fiat, you short-circuit the Father's way. Now, this is a section entitled The Father's Supreme Rule. Social inequality is indispensable to this inevitability of altruism. So that, to recognize that, how much that flies in the face of so-called common wisdom, that there's nothing good about social inequality. No, there's actually everything good about it. It's there by the hand of the Infinite Father, who has a hard time doing things less than infinitely. There's infinite goodness in social inequality. Now, not in eternity. You know, and if you forget that you live in time and not in eternity, if you forget to inform your spiritual consciousness that there's time, which it doesn't know about innately, it thinks everything is in eternity, then you make this very, very grave error. And you know, so you start with that. You can take it to the next step. Maybe before I do that, you guys want to throw in any comment there?
No, I'm still listening.
Nope. Keep going.
Hey, you're on a pretty good roll there, Chris. We can talk some more after this last couple paragraphs in the section.
Okay. There's a, you know, another example of this I thought might be worth bringing in. In paper 70, section 9, paragraph 7, so that's where that is right at the end there of section 9. I guess I didn't say the page number, did I? That's a single column, page 794. And, you know, so they've been talking along these lines. It's a section entitled Human Rights. And they, you know, so just on that point, you know, really of assuming that all men are born equal, they say, but this equality ideal is the child of civilization. It is not found in nature. Even culture itself demonstrates conclusively the inherent inequality of men by their very unequal capacity, therefore. The sudden and non-evolutionary realization of supposed natural equality would quickly throw civilized man back to the crude usages of primitive ages. Society cannot offer equal rights to all, but it can promise to administer the varying rights of each with fairness and equity. It is the business and duty of society to provide the child of nature with a fair and peaceful opportunity to pursue self-maintenance, participate in self-perpetuation, while at the same time enjoying some measure of self-gratification, the sum of all three constituting human happiness. Notice that there's happiness again.
Marvelous paragraph, and needs to be read several times, because people can, they start reading it, like you were saying, Kermit, and it just goes right in the face of the spiritual consciousness. No, everybody
right.
should be.
Right. Equal, the word equal is a spirit word. Equality is a spirit word. Equity is the cosmic word. Yeah, so it's a lot like what we talked about with when Jesus was making these presentations to the apostles here that we're reading about in paper 140. He doesn't flatten the picture down to the spiritual plane and hand it to them, because it will be false then. He presents the whole three-dimensional cosmic structure and then is trusting that if they're sincere and earnest, they can extract out the spirit of that cosmic structure. True equality is the spirit of equity. Equity is something more. It takes into account individuality as well as unity and the superadditive relationship between the two in a full three-dimensional cosmic picture. Because man so now zealously favors his spiritual consciousness without taking up the challenge of balance and subsequent harmony, you know, we're actively trying to do these things that the revelators are saying are the most problematic things that you can do. You know, look what they just pointed out there. If we, you know, we're trying really hard to achieve this. They say if we achieve that to any significant degree, we will throw ourselves back into a very dark age.
Wow.
Where the crude usages of primitive times will have to come back into play. Like mass extermination. You know, in order to impose order. Do we really want to do that?
Wow. Quiet here. Notice that, Chris? I have a feeling it's very quiet. If people are listening to, their minds are going, wait, wait, wait. The very thing that we, that I say we, the collective we, consider that we're progressing forward is actually, we're in danger.
Right, because it's change without growth.
Uh-huh.
The progress that's true is progress that's the downstepped expression of a higher fact called growth. If you try to do progress from the bottom up, sub-growth, you will get only evil and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, we've been
seeing that. If you try to stick an ism on the end, you can't, you know, we must be a progressive people, but that's because we're allowing God the Supreme to progress us. We've supplied the favorable conditions for growth. But if we think that it's, we should take it up, we should apply zeal to the word progressive and stick an ism on the end, then it all goes very, very bad. Progressivism is one of the four biggie problems.
You know, we've been talking about this, you know, we're back when we were talking about Lucifer Rebellion and a lot of previous topics on this program. And here we have it in black and white, a true, very literal warning about some of the things that are going on today. It's right here in black and white.
Yeah. So, like I stressed there, notice how when you find these relevant passages, the word happiness appears in them, tied right back to this section that really defines the eight facets of happiness. Paper 140 that we're reading. Now, and coming to understand what that word means, in distinction from joy, for instance, you know, that you have the right to pursue happiness in a true governmental system. You don't have the right to happiness because that's illogical. That's when you think it's the right to joy. Now, happiness is a choice. And you have the right to make that choice, especially the sublime right to make that choice in the most harshest of environments. To take away the harsh environment is to take away the potential for supreme choice. Those are the inevitabilities.
Yeah.
You mean we've still got to deal with conflict, struggle, effort, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress? I threw the sequence out there a little.
Yeah, you wanted that conflict first to get it over with, James.
Yeah. Oh, how did you pick up on that?
Yeah, so it's just, people were, like you said, people were asking last week, it's like, well, you know, what specific prescriptions? I mean, you can't state any. Society cannot offer equal rights to all. So if anyone is thinking about writing a law that gives equal rights to all, that's in violation of what the relators are trying to teach us. And that's a, it's like, well, you know, it's just, it's so problematic. That's because we, if you view that statement in a plane, in the spiritual plane, it just seems abjectly an abomination.
Yeah.
You can't understand how could they say that? It's like you have to see the cosmic, the three-dimensional structure. And then you can see how in that you can take into account that all men are not born equal, and yet there can be that spirit of equality, and you know, along with that fact. But without two eyes and the three-dimensional vision that the two eyes give, it just seems ridiculous, if not an affront to everything that you hold dear, for the book to say society cannot offer equal rights to all.
Yeah.
You know, now think about how problematic this is. How long will it be before a politician can run on that platform and win?
A while. A while. Yeah.
You know, but the relatives are saying, it's got to happen pretty soon, guys, or you're going to be wallowing in crude usages.
Hmm.
So, you know, it just, you know, when the truths of the fifth epical revelation starts to sink in, you know, you sort of sigh and take a really deep breath and say, wow, obviously I can't do a lot to transform the minds of all men in these regards. I guess I better start with myself, and maybe I can work on one more person that's close to me. It's going to have to start small, because there's no way it can start big.
Well, that would be too fast, like we've been talking about, people. But, you know, we've had too many things happen too quickly socially, in my opinion, in the last 50 years. I think that's why there's been some chaos going on. It's just...
There's one other little paragraph I could read along this line if we're still game, or do you want to keep moving on?
Yeah, go for it.
Throw it out there. Throw it out.
No.
What do we got?
We'll take the cards and letters.
Yeah, as long as they say to Chris Halverson.
Maybe I should give my email address here.
Nah, hey, we got your back. We got your back, Dr. Chris.
Now, this is a... I thought this would be a good place to remind people of one of the most significant paragraphs in the book in this regard, that starts at the bottom of page 956 in the single column. It's paper 86, section 7, paragraph 4. This is speaking directly to
what
this...
Page? What page is that, Chris?
956, the bottom of 956, rolling over onto 957. This is the paragraph where they actually directly address how, you know, the problematic assumptions of progressivism. You know, how you take something that is innately positive, like the fact of progression, and in human ignorance you apply an ism to it, and you end up with something that the revelators, you know, the celestials are just going, oh, my Lord. Here's what they say about that. Modern civilized races are just emerging from ghost fear as an explanation of luck and the commonplace inequalities of existence. Ooh, there's that inequality thing, see? Mankind is achieving emancipation from the bondage of the ghost spirit explanation of ill luck. Now, so we're not quite as primitive and superstitious. But While men are giving up the erroneous doctrine of a spirit cause of the vicissitudes of life, they exhibit a surprising willingness to accept an almost equally fallacious teaching, which bids them attribute all human inequalities to political misadaptation, social injustice, and industrial competition. But new legislation, increasing philanthropy, and more industrial reorganization, however good in and of themselves, will not remedy the facts of birth and the accidents of living. Only comprehension of facts and wise manipulation within the laws of nature will enable man to get what he wants and to avoid what he does not want. Scientific knowledge leading to scientific action is the only antidote for so-called accidental ills. So you can see again they're addressing this, this assumption that all men are born equal, which just seems such a wonderful thing for your spiritual consciousness to grab a hold of. So you know that all men are born equal, but then you look around and you go, but I'm not seeing equality. Therefore, there must be some vast conspiracy thwarting, what was meant for us in the Garden of Eden.
Yep.
There must be political misadaptation, social injustice, and industrial competition. These are the three fundamental assumptions of progressivism, that's what's behind human inequalities. And the remedies are legislation, redistribution of wealth, and regulation. Those are the unquestioned tenets. I like to point out, you may need, new legislation for some reason. You may need some regulation for some reason. But none of that has anything to do with human inequalities. Those are based on biology, the fact that all men are not born equal. And no amount of redistributing wealth or whatever is going to alter people's DNA.
Or the accidents of living.
Right. Which can only be solved by getting enough scientific knowledge that you can begin to control, the forces of nature a bit.
Right.
Like knowing how to, build a house that's strong enough to, withstand a storm. That happens through scientific development. Or figuring out how to live near big rivers, like the flood, instead of just mindlessly living there like primitive people, and every once in a while 100,000 of you die when the river floods.
Or obstetrical care. All of that.
Yeah. Just, right. So, and it's, again, when has there not been a politician, who hasn't promised, it doesn't matter if they're left or right, they all promise to solve some human inequality by passing certain legislation or redistributing things or getting some regulations in play that's going to fix those evil whoever's that are doing such and so. Because that's why you don't live an equal life, they say. No, it's not true. As a matter of fact, the revelers say it's one of the most obscene, fallacious thoughts that mankind has ever thought of. So here we are.
That's one reason I've never put much stock in political activism. I have a lot of friends that think that's the way to go, but I haven't seen it, slip into synchrony with these teachings, like you're pointing out, Chris. I just haven't seen it. if I see it someday, maybe I'll get on.
Yeah, and you notice how they very carefully put that parenthetical in, because they know we think in dichotomies.
Right.
And so the moment they say, you know, that maybe industrial reorganization isn't the answer, the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, so you're saying that we should just give them carte blanche to do any old damn thing
right.
they please. No.
Right.
However good in and of themselves those things might be. But, you know, people aren't driven zealously to these tenets because, you know, they love to contemplate the deals of industry and how it's best, you know, manage. No, they have this zeal burning that they're going to eliminate human inequalities if they do these things.
Hmm.
That's what drives them. And that's one of the greatest fallacies in human history. Like I said, it's one of the four biggies. Positivism, progressivism, secularism, and humanism.
All right.
Those are the four biggies.
But a chicken in every pot will get you elected.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will.
Don't that just work dandy?
I wasn't able to get it. There was a question earlier on from the same listener. Could you might distinguish or speak to the issue of equality of opportunity versus equality of results? Can the former even be possible?
Well, see, that specifically, you know, we can go back to paper 140. See, that specifically is what Jesus was trying to point out and what the midwayers are trying to point out. What's the difference between social justice, precisely recognized and defined, and social equality? Social justice is giving equal opportunity.
Right.
Social equality is demanding equal results.
Yes, there it is.
Which is impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, even if we were in the age of light and life, there would still be men and women, and they'd still be different.
Yes.
Pretty sure.
Thank you for bringing that up.
they're not equal.
No.
They're different. And God made them that way. The question
for mankind
is why? Why did he make us different? You know, and to see that in the context of time, all the other differences that exist, someone plays piano better than another person, you know, et cetera, et cetera. James is an infinitely better musician, and he's only a finite being, than me.
That is so true.
Jared himself.
I mean, there obviously is some vast conspiracy that thwarted me, because we're by definition born equal. So where's my oppressor? So that I can rise up in anger against him.
Hey, I'll trade you some cords for some brain cells.
James, well, I want to go back to what you were saying about politics. In a season of time, whenever it happens, and it may very well be happening, we're not aware of it. We're told that there will be those that get a hold of this revelation, hopefully, and go into politics with these, having had this all tied together as best they could, to try to plant those seeds and make a difference, but within the system of that.
Right, and of course that would be that would be great, but as we've been pointing out here, if they really, you know, sauntered into that arena carrying the flag, they'd get not only laughed out, they might get shot, run down, run out on a rail for such drastic and inhuman type of beliefs.
We got a long ways to go before
the season of time.
Oh yeah, I mean,
well,
the
yeah.
last thing you're going to want to do is waltz out into public political view holding this book in your hand.
No, and I certainly wasn't recommending that. Well, I said get this an understanding, an in-depth understanding,
right.
and let it be weaved
right.
into the fiber. It'll slowly happen.
Well, you know, and you pointed out, Chris, you pointed out a little thing, you just mentioned it, and I think it cannot be overemphasized, is the tendency to think in dichotomies. So if there's any one thing that any of us as individuals can do is, you know, a recognition of that in our own lives and in our own thinking and begin to address that. That is so pernicious and it's so widespread that it goes almost virtually unrecognized. It goes unrecognized in rank and file.
Yeah, yeah. And as Jesus tries to point out in the Discourse on Reality, if you have, if your associating mechanism, if your agitant mind, thinks in a dichotomy. You know, if it always closes one of the two eyes whenever it looks at anything, that means by definition you can't even see reality.
Right. Right.
So that every time you even use that word, you're delusional.
Great.
He's very strong in his statements about that reality cannot be seen if you have one of these dichotomy biases in your sight of the world, because it is immediately absolutized into a worldview, and it just, you know, it finds a noun and it sticks an ism on the end, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
You're not a cosmic citizen anymore. You know, you've taken yourself out of the game. Yeah. Yes, your salvation is not in jeopardy or anything like that. You'll make it to the next life. But you're not going to be any good to God in this life.
No.
He can't use you if you're not cosmic. The only reason he could use Jesus, like we're trying to point out, is because Jesus wasn't merely spiritual in his spiritual, purely spiritual mission. He was cosmic.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, let's read this, these final paragraphs here, and I think there's more that we can bring in, and I hope our listeners are patient with this ride. Jesus frequently warned his listeners against covetousness, declaring that a man's happiness consists not in the abundance of his material possessions. He constantly reiterated, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" He made no direct attack on the possession of property, but he did insist that it is eternally essential that spiritual values come first. In his later teachings, he sought to correct many erroneous Urantia views of life by narrating numerous parables which he presented in the course of his public ministry. Jesus never intended to formulate economic theories. He well knew that each age must evolve its own remedies for existing troubles. And if Jesus were on earth today, living his life in the flesh, he would be a great disappointment to the majority of good men and women for the simple reason that he would not take sides in the present-day political, social, or economic disputes. He would remain grandly aloof while teaching you how to perfect your inner spiritual life so as to render you manyfold more competent to attack the solution of your purely human problems.
Yes. Let me go ahead and finish the last one, and then we'll
dive
into
you?
More. Jesus would make all men godlike and then stand by sympathetically while these sons of God solved their own political, social, and economic problems. It was not wealth that he denounced, but what wealth does to the majority of its devotees. On this Thursday afternoon, Jesus first told his associates that it is more blessed to give than to receive. So we've got more in here that we can dig into.
You know, just like Kermit was saying, you notice the simple little things that you can just start to do yourself. The next time you're tempted, you know, that your adjutant mind with its biases is tempted to denounce wealth, remember what it said. You know? It was not wealth that he denounced. You know, if you see yourself as a follower of Jesus, then follow him. Stop denouncing wealth. You know, and it doesn't matter, you know, how popular an idea that is. You're going to have the courage, you know, to stand separate and not just parrot that, because then you'll get along with the crowd. You know, if you have to, just keep your mouth shut.
How do you do that?
Stop denouncing it. You know? Because the revelation, if you believe in the revelation, you know it tells you to not do that. That's sowing the seeds of calamity in mankind for you to open your mouth and speak that. And it doesn't matter if it's like, well, I'm just one of a million. You know, it's not really making it worse. You know, and I have friends then. It's like, well, choose this day whom you will serve. And then the other thing, of course, that he, you know, brings out in that verse of those last two paragraphs you read, I mean, you know, that's one of the saddest ironies of all this. You have people that they desire good things, and they see that it's very difficult for many people to have a lot of opportunity in their life because there's a lot of greed and gluttony and what have you, and tyranny. But if you look closely at their thought processes, they don't turn out to be quite as idealistic as it initially appears. Really, at the root of their thoughts is covetousness. They covet what that other person has. He has a bigger TV than I do. you know, and they expose themselves, you know, for the problem I pointed out. I mean, they have the word idealism in their head, but they forgot there's an ism on the end there. You got to be really careful with. It's false if the adjective is material, idealism. You know, if your ideal is for everyone's material things to be equal, same amount in every bank account, same, everyone has the same size house, you know, et cetera. No, it has to be spiritual idealism. Because it's just almost a given. If it's material idealism, you know, what's really driving you is a level of the flesh covetousness. You covet what the wealthy man has. You know, and so you aren't even taking up the challenge of Moses and the Ten Commandments yet. You got a long ways to go to get to the fifth epical revelation.
For those out there who want to do some complimentary reading, I'm not going to go into it, but I would suggest kind of a bookend. Is paper 163. It's called The Ordination of the 70 at Magadan. We're reading, of course, paper 140, The Ordination of the Apostles. But the first couple of sections in this paper dive totally into these same topics that we're talking about. Section 2 is The Rich Young Man and Others. Gives us a very specific account of the young man, Matadormus, who was wanting to be a follower and of course, was denied because he didn't want to give up his wealth. But then it goes on into Section 3, the discussion about wealth. And it goes deeply into these whole things. And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And
talk
then
about
plus,
script,
as we just read, he gives and he gives a parable. How about that? He's talking, the revelators have just told us that he started using parables later to talk about these things, and he gives a wonderful parable on page 1804 of this paper 163. Anyway, just some suggested reading.
Yeah, maybe one other little thing, just so people can appreciate a little bit better when they mention how Jesus would be such a great disappointment to most spiritually conscious people today if he were around, because he wouldn't address the political, social, and economic. There's a little element of history that the revelators point out that should be appreciated in that regard. We could bring that in as well. It's in paper 97, section 9, the second to the last paragraph there, which is 28. It's a really long section. So 97, 9, 28. It's on page 1075. To remember that Jesus is working very hard to be a spiritual uplifter purely, to foster the solidification of true beginnings of religion. And in that second to last paragraph in section 9 there, paper 97, they speak to this. They say the doctrine of immortality also took form at Babylon. So you can see we're in this whole process of talking about the evolution of Hebrew religion. And it said the Jews had thought that the idea of the future life detracted from the emphasis of their gospel of social justice. Now, for the first time, theology displaced sociology and economics. Religion was taking shape as a system of human thought and conduct, more and more to be separated from politics, sociology, and economics. Notice they're in the same order as in paper 140, politics, yeah. Sociology, and economics. So Jesus knows that there's been this long evolutionary struggle, and it's finally gotten so that religion is beginning to separate out of the morass with everything else. And he's trying very carefully to foster that faint flicker of religion and not, tweak it back into the puddle with all the other stuff. And so that's another reason, very directly in terms of his efforts being evolutional, how he's trying to take a hold of that budding fact and carefully nurture it, into the clear. Now, the fifth epical revelation is trying to get politics separated from society and society separated from economics and et cetera. It's trying to even more separate things out from that puddle it was all initially in. But Jesus is just trying to take that first step, because religion is the spark to get the process going.
Yeah, yep. Well, I do have one more recommended reading, which is right along these lines, and it comes from paper 132, The Sojourn at Rome, section 5, Counseling the Rich Man. And this is quite of a long section, too. It goes for more than two pages, section 5. That begins on page 1462, and it actually goes into great depth about wealth, earned wealth, accidental wealth, all the different types. It's got quite a bit of detail that can help the reader to expand their study on this whole topic.
Yeah, very good. You know, that like I was, mentioning when you were bringing that up earlier, that there is, even in the midst of the Jesus papers, there's these passages that are very precise and, going into all the little details and teasing them apart and giving specific comments about, it's very, very much into the details. It's not just that sweeping unity picture. And it has a lot to do with the midwayers, bringing this into the fifth epical revelation. They're trying to give you the cosmic picture that was behind the scenes a lot of times in Jesus' efforts, bring that to the fore in all of its detail, so that we don't just have the spirit of it that the apostles were straining to try to get a hold of.
Well, there's just one more thing that I'd like to inject here that I think has some relevance, and it comes from paper 99, The Social Problems of Religion, which talks a lot about social, economic, and religious changes. You'll find a lot of economics mentioned throughout this paper. It's actually kind of surprising. When you dig into it and find out how much they are talking about the existing social order, political and economic culture, and economic and political systems. They talk about economic adjustments over and over. But then we get to this section 2, and the second paragraph, it reads, "Institutional religion is now caught in the stalemate of a vicious circle. It cannot reconstruct society without reconstructing itself. And being so much an integral part of the established order, it cannot reconstruct itself until society has been radically reconstructed." Now, that goes, in specifics there to institutional religion. But if you look on both sides of that statement, you'll find they're talking about economic systems, economic organizations, very much throughout here. And I can't help thinking that the same thing holds true, that that our economic system is caught in the stalemate of this vicious circle.
That's
we talked
a great,
about a little while ago.
That's a great quote. See, to go with that one that I brought in from paper 97. See, they're pointing that out. Since, religion is what initiates all these processes. And so if it hasn't gotten itself out of the pool with everything else, then you're stuck in this catch-22. See, and they're pointing that out. It's, Jesus wasn't as successful as he had hoped. And it's tended... material gravity has tended to drag it back into the pool with everything else again. And so now there's no way to initiate anything because religion is caught up with everything else.
Yeah, it's a problem. And, what I read there is kind of stark, and I really don't know how to approach this when it says that something so huge as institutional religion cannot reconstruct itself until society has been radically reconstructed. That's like a double challenge, and both of them need reconstructing.
Yeah, and like we've been pointing out, I mean, especially, it's one thing to reconstruct, but to radically reconstruct, not only is that going to take time, that's going to take lots and lots and lots of time.
Yeah.
For right. evolution to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we start with ourselves, and we trust. You know, and we work to supply the favorable conditions to be reborn. And if nothing else, we can at least try to pass that on to our children. Maybe we can't even figure out how to pass it on to our best friend. But if we can pass it on to our children, you know, if a few people do that, as generations go by, a phenomenon begins to grow. But, you know, to think that you can somehow just be so clever that you know, or to attain such power that you're just going to sweep the world in fiat, you know, there's a guy that thought he could do that. He thought he could do the whole local system like that.
Mm.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, he was going to take everyone in the local system to light and life tomorrow. He was fed up with this time thing. You know,
yeah.
Those overlords telling him to be patient and just let it slowly develop and trust God the Supreme. You know, he'd had enough of that.
Well, there are those who would claim and point to this revelation as a starting point. But unfortunately, as we're discovering, so few of its devotees are able to penetrate to these levels that we're talking about tonight.
But it's doable, you know. The basics are not complicated, but they do take courageous and independent cosmic thinking. And the most difficult thing to be independent of is not your neighbor. It's not that other guy. You have to try to somehow think independently of your adjutant mind's biases, your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. That's the great challenge of independence. Mm-hmm. Can you rule? Can you become the master of that self, that animal origin self? And think independent of your genetic and environmental biases.
And stop that dichotomous thinking.
Yeah, working on that. Well, what do you think, Anne? Would you like to take us into the next subsection?
Sure. 5, personal religion. You, as did his apostles, should the better understand Jesus' teachings by his life. He lived a perfected life on Urantia, and his unique teachings can only be understood when that life is visualized in its immediate background. It is his life, and not his lessons to the 12 or his sermons to the multitudes, that will assist most in revealing the Father's divine character and loving personality. We've been discussing this for several broadcasts, this very thing.
Yeah, so this is the spot where they really emphatically put it down in print. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life.
Life.
There's no and teachings. The religious life of Jesus and how he lived
it. How he lived it, yeah. And what's interesting, I would dare say that I'd say about half of older seasoned Urantiate readers could totally quote that. But when you sit down to really discuss it, it is interpreted as knowing his teachings. But, it's looking across his life, yeah.
Not to mention that you may not notice that the word is knowledge. It seems like a very uninspiring word.
Of all human knowledge.
We should probably give the reference page for that cross reference quote. You think? Yeah.
Yep. Sure. Someone got it. I don't have
got
it in
it
hand
there,
here.
Got it there handy? I know where it's.
Paper 196.
Yeah.
I'll let you guys find it. You're already on the task here.
Are you looking, James?
No. I'm looking for something else.
I'll get it.
Well, if I can spell knowledge, I can get it real quick. Okay, it's paper 196. Section 1, paragraph 3,
2090.
Yep, bottom 2090. Of 2090 here.
Yep. 2090, very good, thank you. And the other one that I think is a parallel to this one is found in paper 169 on page 1856, which says, "You learn about God from Jesus by observing the divinity of his life, not by depending on his teachings."
That's it.
You know, and so, you know, just that I mentioned the knowledge thing, because, you know, even if you kind of get over the spiritual hurdle of, okay, I'll allow the word to be knowledge and not say truth or something, but, you know, you think knowledge, it's like, well, wouldn't the teachings be the way I get the knowledge? Isn't that like the immediate connection?
Mm.
No, you need to look at his life, and you need to be able to recognize the knowledge in his life. It's like, well, that sounds really difficult. Yeah. It's not a matter of just reading some words and memorizing them. Yeah, so... Yeah, if you the more you think about it, you know, there's a distinct challenge at every turn. This, you know, the relators don't give you any easy outs.
I was gonna say it's not easy. That's right. You're working on it day by day. Jesus did not attack the teachings of the Hebrew prophets or the Greek moralists. The Master recognized the many good things which these good teachers stood for, but he had come down to earth to teach something additional, the voluntary conformity of man's will to God's will. Jesus did not want simply to produce a religious man, a mortal wholly occupied with religious feelings and actuated only by spiritual impulses. Could you have had but one look at him, you would have known that Jesus was a real man of great experience in the things of this world. The teachings of Jesus in this respect have been grossly perverted and much misrepresented all down through the centuries of the Christian era. You have also held perverted ideas about the Master's meekness and humility. What he aimed at in his life appears to have been a superb self-respect. He only advised man to humble himself that he might truly become exalted. What he really aimed at was true humility toward God. He placed great value upon sincerity, a pure heart. Fidelity was a cardinal virtue in his estimate of character, while courage was at the very heart of his teachings. Fear not was his watchword, and patient endurance his ideal of strength of character. The teachings of Jesus constitute a religion of valor, courage, and heroism, and this is just why he chose as his personal representatives 12 commonplace men, the majority of whom were rugged, virile, and manly fishermen.
Yeah.
What a paragraph, man.
Yeah, it is. It's just so massive.
Wow.
You know, there's just so many things to reflect on there. You know, you see how he came to teach something additional.
Yeah.
You know, and to say simply produce a religious man, I mean, can you see what's between the lines there? There's a super additive consequence that he's striving for. You know, why do they go on and emphasize all of this definitive relationship with material reality, with knowledge, with things, with you know, in combination with that religious? And he didn't want to simply produce a religious man. He wanted to produce a philosophic man, a cosmic man. By getting that man to find the religious spark and letting the super additivity happen. You know? But it's only going to happen if you're like him, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived his. He didn't go off in isolation so that there was no super additivity potential. Or you're just locked up in this little spiritual bubble as a merely religious man. If you engage that in the world, you'll become a philosophic man, and you'll have everything that the Hebrew prophets and the Greek moralists and more as part of your nature.
I do like what he aimed at his life appears to have been a superb self-respect. Because that has truly been misunderstood, what true self-respect versus being humble and meek, the way he's been presented to the world. It has been very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's you see how it's a balance point. Like you were just reminding that there's been a tendency to go sub self-respect.
Yeah, just almost been over, yeah.
And then, of course, then there's the other side where those go super, and then it becomes negative. Anything above self-respect becomes progressively, steadily more negative. Above that, if you take it above the fourth level of meaning where it's self-respect, you take it up to the fifth, it becomes self-esteem. And it's going distinctly negative. You take it all the way up to the sixth level of meaning, and now it's self-admiration, self-love, love of self. You know, and you're right there with Mr. Lucifer.
Well, you recall his teaching about self-respect and how he very carefully threaded the needle with his teaching. He came to restore self-respect to those who had lost it, but to restrain it in those who already have it. So he's really looking for that fine tuning of that particular quality.
Yeah, I mean that little Q&A that I have on the site about love your neighbor. It ends with this, pointing out like in paper 159, paragraph 3, or section 3, paragraph 3. The phrase is over much self-respect. That's a simple example of how all good things taken to extremes become bad.
Right.
You can't go. That's the ceiling, the fourth level. Don't take it up. Where everything starts to reverse. Yeah, so that all those subtle things of how, like we're talking about with equity, that they're in a cosmic system. Everything has its place. From a merely spiritual consciousness, you know what place everything has. The ceiling.
Yeah.
No, everything has a place in a three-dimensional structure. The floor is just as important as the ceiling. And everything in between.
Jesus had little to say about the social vices of his day. Seldom did he make reference to moral delinquency. He was a positive teacher of true virtue. He studiously avoided the negative method of imparting instruction. He refused to advertise evil. He was not even a moral reformer. He well knew, and so taught his apostles, that the sensual urges of mankind are not suppressed by either religious rebuke or legal prohibition. His few denunciations were largely directed against pride, cruelty, oppression, and hypocrisy. Jesus did not vehemently denounce even the Pharisees, as did John. He knew many of the scribes and Pharisees were honest of heart. He understood their enslaving bondage to religious traditions. Jesus laid great emphasis on first making the tree good. He impressed the three that he valued the whole life, not just a few special virtues. Certain few special virtues.
Yep, all very important points to reflect on. You know, relatively approachable, but very important. You know, there's one in there that we've mentioned a few times recently on the broadcast, that he was, that bit about few denunciations, largely directed against pride. He was really aggressive. If he saw the faintest flicker of pride, he just pounced on it. And read him the Riot Act, because that's that goes before the fall. If you let spiritual energy, because pride is a spiritual word, it's spiritual pride. If you give any quarter to that, self-animating spirit substance just carries that away geometrically immediately. And so that's why he was so quick. I mean, if you just, they didn't even have to speak it. If they just, he could tell they were thinking it. he would just stick his finger right in their face and just chew them out.
Rebuke, yes, indeed.
Yeah. And, of course, we know how he felt about hypocrisy when he addressed the Sanhedrin.
All those things of, where you're really, manifesting pollution of the temple.
You did bring up Mr. Lucifer himself there. In paper 54, we've got a direct here, and in section 1, in true liberty is the associate of genuine self-respect.
Mm.
False liberty is the consort of self-admiration. Mm. True liberty is the fruit of self-control. False liberty, the assumption of self-assertion. Self-control leads to altruistic service. Self-admiration tends towards the exploitation of others for the selfish aggrandizement of such a mistaken individual as willing to sacrifice righteous attainment for the sake of possessing unjust power over his fellow beings.
Yeah.
Of course, we went through that a while back when we were...
That's a great way to bring in now, James.
Yeah, to emphasize the oppression word that was in the list there with pride, cruelty, and hypocrisy.
Yeah.
So you have that spiritual knife edge of pride, and of course just being primitive, cruelty, and then the oppression, that comes from all those things you were just reading.
Kermit, you want to pick up? Are we finished with this part? Any more? Any other comments?
I don't know. Is there anything else?
There's a lot that could
bring
be
out
said.
There.
We could go on.
Yeah. I mean, you notice how
we've got a courage and pure heart. Those things, fear not. I mean, these are right at the heart of what we're doing here, trying to summarize the Master's teaching. I didn't want to just blow by those. sincerity, a pure heart.
That's, you know, reflecting on what's the difference between valor and courage and heroism. You know.
Yes.
There's so many rich things in there that you can reflect upon. You know, and then they never miss a chance to throw in a little technical thing of, you know, if you're a student of the Bible, you know, they point you to John and, you know, and reminding you that some of that, you know, is not Jesus, that's John, that denouncing.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, shall we carry on?
Yeah, let me.
The one thing which John gained from this day's teaching was that the heart of Jesus' religion consisted in the acquirement of a compassionate character coupled with a personality motivated to do the will of the Father in heaven. Peter grasped the idea that the gospel they were about to proclaim was really a fresh beginning for the whole human race. He conveyed this impression subsequently to Paul, who formulated therefrom his doctrine of Christ as the second Adam. James grasped the thrilling truth that Jesus wanted his children on earth to live as though they were already citizens of the completed heavenly kingdom. Jesus knew men were different.
Just real quickly,
okay.
I mean, the one little thing there is, you know, he gives all of this complexity. We just spent two broadcasts to talk about, and, you know, what the three got, okay, they were solid, but not a lot of detail there.
here's a takeaway. Do you think they delivered all this information, that Peter delivered all this information to Andrew? I mean, that's where this is coming from, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly, you know, if they, you know, how much Peter delivered, you know, how much they're just using it as a, you know, as sort of the framework, you know, for what they've given
us. That's what I've always thought, or not always, and as I studied, that's just a framework, because they brought forth some really powerful things. And
maybe one little technical thing, if people have pondered, you know, what does that second Adam expression mean? Here's a nice little, you know, explanation so that you can understand that, what the meaning of that expression is, you know, Jesus is the second Adam.
Jesus knew men were different, and he so taught his apostles. He constantly exhorted them to refrain from trying to mold the disciples and believers according to some set pattern. He sought to allow each soul to develop in its own way, a perfecting and separate individual before God. In answer to one of Peter's many questions, the Master said, "I want to set men free so that they can start out afresh as little children upon the new and better life." Jesus always insisted that true goodness must be unconscious in bestowing charity, not allowing the left hand to know what the right hand does. The three apostles
were... Jesus knew men were different, that they weren't born equal.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Do the followers of Jesus know that?
No.
Yeah. And, of course, the pride thing at the end there with the left hand, right hand.
Yeah. The three apostles were shocked this afternoon when they realized that their master's religion made no provision for spiritual self-examination. All religions before and after the times of Jesus, even Christianity, carefully provided for conscientious self-examination. But not so with the religion of Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus' philosophy of life is without religious introspection. The carpenter's son never taught character building. He taught character growth, declaring that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. But Jesus said nothing which would proscribe self-analysis as a prevention of conceited egotism.
What about providing for, unfortunately, over-conscientious self-examination?
Well, sure.
Like we talked about recently. Yeah. You know, and there, of course, you know, hearkening to the religion papers like James was there with paper 99, you know, man cannot cause growth.
Right.
Carpenter's son never taught character building. He taught character growth. But he can supply favorable conditions for God the Supreme to grow you. More technically, God the Mother. Aspect of God the Supreme to grow you. That's just a really, really tough one for humans to wrap their minds around. They're certain that they can cause growth.
And this is typical of the
This
is typical of the revelators. The last sentence is to blunt or to eliminate that tendency to dichotomize. You know, that doesn't mean you don't reflect and do some self-analysis when you're, evaluating your progress and guarding against overstepping. So the right to enter the kingdom is conditioned by faith, personal belief. The cost of remaining in the progressive ascent of the kingdom is the pearl of great price, in order to possess which a man sells all that he has. The teaching of Jesus is a religion for everybody, not alone for weaklings and slaves. His religion never became crystallized during his day into creeds and theological laws. He left not a line of writing behind him. His life and teachings were bequeathed to the universe as an inspirational and idealistic inheritance, suitable for the spiritual guidance and moral instruction of all ages on all worlds. Even today, Jesus' teaching stands apart from all religions as such, albeit it is the living hope of every one of them. Jesus did not teach his apostles that religion is man's only earthly pursuit. That was the Jewish idea of serving God. But he did insist that religion was the exclusive business of the 12. Jesus taught nothing to deter his believers from the pursuit of genuine culture. He only detracted from the tradition-bound religious schools of Jerusalem. He was liberal, big-hearted, learned, and tolerant. Self-conscious piety had no place in his philosophy of righteous living. The Master offered no solutions for the non-religious problems of his own age, nor for any subsequent age. Jesus wished to develop spiritual insight into eternal realities and to stimulate initiative in the originality of living. He concerned himself exclusively with the underlying and permanent spiritual needs of the human race. He revealed a goodness equal to God. He exalted love, truth, beauty, and goodness as the divine ideal and the eternal reality. The Master came to create in man a new spirit, a new will, to impart a new capacity for knowing the truth, experiencing compassion, and choosing goodness, the will to be in harmony with God's will coupled with the eternal urge to become perfect, even as the Father in heaven is perfect.
Just one little quick thing I'd like to throw in there. Just notice how they're pointing out that because the fourth epical revelation is a dispensational revelation, it's designed to be universalizable. If it's pure, if it's taken out in pure form, it can be universalized. And I'm stressing that. You know, not even, universalizable throughout the whole of Nebadon even.
Right.
Let alone on this planet. The fifth epical revelation is not a dispensational one, and it's more of a starting point, than a completion point.
An important clarification there, Chris.
Very.
Very, very.
It's a hard sell among our devotees. Yeah.
We're going to have to come back and dive into this with a little recap next week, I think, because we got through this, but how about we do that next week, drive back in, because we're about out of time, aren't we?
Yep.
We are. We're down to below 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, my.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Wow.
Great study tonight.
Oh, my. And I will tell you that about the economics, that first hour and 15 minutes, that really is important. important to go back and reflect on, listen to, study, to tie it all together, because it's some startling insights that most of us have missed all these years of studying the Revelation. Well, thanks for being with us, everybody. Are we down to 10 seconds, Kermit?
We're down to zero.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Love you.
Take care, everyone. Love y'all. Bye for now.